like to thank the organizers for inviting me. I just wanted to come and learn something, but they did ask me to give a talk, and I don't know whether what I'm going to talk about is of interest to anybody in this conference, but at least it is. I'm going to report on some joint work I was doing with Alain Bourget. Dimitri Jacobson and John Todd, so who's one of the organizers. So in that sense, maybe that's my defense for giving this talk, I guess. So he might show up a bit later, I guess. So I couldn't come. And I'm sort of the junior partner in this group. So anything I say, if it's well known to you or if it's trivial, don't blame it on them. It's just blame it on me. So it's about Gordon spin chains. So I have to explain what a Gordon spin chain is and then tell you about what we're trying to do with those things. And so I hope if you know these things already, just sit back and lunch will be soon in about 30 minutes. So a Gordon spin chain, I'll start with the Riemann sphere. Pick points on the Riemann sphere. This is a punctured Riemann sphere. And the infinity is a special point. And I have sites. A spin chain is a chain of sites where you have spins. The sites are ordered from 0 to n. And each site I have these points. Well, infinity is a special point. And then I have representations of a group, let's say SL2. And so at each site I have a finite dimensional vector space. Given by a representation of a group, let's say SL2 of a maximal of weight lambda. Need not be finite dimensional if we talk about highest weight modules. So the lambda you can think of as so SL2 has three generators. I write them S plus up and down thing and the diagonal stuff. Little SL2. And it acts on say polynomials in one variable, and I'll act like that. The plus is just multiplication by Z. And the minus is, minus would pull one, no, I better write things down correctly. You can think of it like that. The minus would pull one down, actually. Minus 2 lambda. These are operators on polynomials, let's say. And then the S, this would be S plus, S minus. S would be just this, well, it doesn't change the degree, right? That's lambda. So you can think of it like that, as acting on polynomials. And then if lambda is half an integer, positive, then it actually is a finite dimensional representation on the quotient space modulo in the power 2 lambda plus 1. That's the theory of these highest weight gamma modules, like that's what they call. So you can think of it like that. It's just acting on some space, like that, and the brackets are correct. I hope I put it on correctly. So it could be infinite dimensional. And so these are the things that act, and the Gordon spin chain is the following. So you let these things act on each side and put a spectral parameter. So this is a complex number, spectral parameter, and then you do these things. So for each of these things, at each side, you act on your vector space at each side and divide by make them poles at alpha i's on the Riemann sphere. And these are operators which depend on u and on the alphas, of course. And so the Gordon spin chain consists, of course, of Hamiltonians, which we would construct out of these things. And the way to do it is, so we want commuting operators. Okay, we should say we're in an integrable system conference, so we want commuting operators. So that's one way to do these things. There are many algebraic ways to find commuting operators, so this is one way that I understand, or I'm going to explain, is to introduce a Casimir, which is so in my convention, it's because my diagonal is half, minus half. So that's a thing which, without the U, would commute with everything in the representation, but with the U, it won't, but still, it commutes with itself. So that's a key fact about this Casimir. For any V. So once you have such an operator that is self-commuting, you can do partial fraction decompositions. and then you get commuting operators. So right TU, so it has a falling partially fraction decomposition, so it has poles. I write N. So I have this new notation in my papers now. Little index and goes always from capital to. Then I don't forget. There are a couple of indices, and then you get all this. So that's when you start. But my collaborators don't like that. I'm insisting. Anyway, there are these operators then at the poles at each side, and sorry, plus then the square terms you will find, the second order terms are the usual Casimirs. Sorry. I have to get used to those. So that's the expansion in terms of the spectral parameter. And of course, they commute. That's where these are the scalars that come from the normal Casimir for each site. Right,
there's this. Oh, sorry.
I think. And then at each I. Oh, okay. So at each site, this Sn is acting on the vector space, right, for each little thing. So you can think of it as a 2x2 matrix at that site. Right? And so the Hilbert space, of course, is a tensor product of all these. So this is acting on the, for each U, this is an operator on the Hilbert space, right? And it acts at each site and on the tensor product. So that's spin chain, that's quantum spin chain. And normal spin chain at each site, you would just have a, say, the usual spin chain is plus and minus split, and then at 2, 0, and then, you know, the quantum spin chain was a C2, because there's a phase. So usual spin chain, the normal classical spin chains are always flips, right, up, down. The quantum spin chain, a flip is a two vectors, you span the C2 space. And in general, you can have other representations. So that's the basic idea behind a quantum spin chain. And now you have these operators that commute, because that commute implies that the HU have to commute, right? With each other. So of course, that in that sense, it is a quantum integrable system. And of course, there are other things you could do there. For example, if you don't like the Riemann sphere and you want to work on an elliptic curve, you use other functions, elliptic functions, which have poles of certain types. From the Riemann sphere, you just use rational functions, so I'll explain the easiest case. But one could also do these things for other things and get other spin chains. But there are only a few possible spin chains where you get commuting Hamiltonians. And algebraically, they're classified by things called R matrices. So that's one version, and there's a trigonometric version, and a few special cases. So they're not that many. You can't pick any old Riemann surface and do these things. It doesn't work. So only for special things. So anyway, that's a Gaudin spin chain. So Gaudin spin chain studies that problem where the commuting operator is there, and these are all the Hamiltonians you want to study. And of course, the problem is finite eigenvectors. So common. Because they commute, we can do that, right? And eigenvectors. So that's the problem, and the method, very classical method, is goes back to Hund's beta ansatz. So to find vectors, you start with something simple. So that's sort of the lowest. Well, they call it the highest weight. Because I like to call it the lowest weight. You start with something very simple, and you create new vectors out of that by acting with those operators. And the way you create is creation operators. I should write in the right order. One, two, well. Yeah, K. Yes, K. Yeah. So you take K numbers, complex numbers, and you apply to that vector, as a physicist notates the vector, apply these operators one by one, where S depends on U. So I can pick complex numbers now. These U's are now some complex numbers, different complex numbers. And then there's these, no, sorry, theta. And of course, the alphas are somewhere else, right? So if you look at the complex plane, it's kind of, it's interspersed. you pick points where you create particles, so to speak. And this is an ansatz.
So let's call it this vector.
And the question is, when is that an eigenvector? Well, it would depend, of course. Well, maybe I shouldn't call this lambda I. Right, for each of these Hamiltonians. And the answer is, well, you can compute it. There's an algebraic way to plug it in, if and only if. Of course, that's a better ansatz equation. You do this. Let's say L naught is okay. And then you add. Now you add the sum over n now, theta k minus alpha n, right, with the weights. So this is over n, this is over all L naught equal to k, and that has to be 0 for all L, for all k. So the k equations and just about points in the plane, in the complex numbers. But somehow it is not that easy to analyze this equation. You might think it's just a simple little rational expression. If you give yourself the alphas, the thetas, you should be able to find all the possible thetas. And in the other models, these will be replaced by sines and other equations. You might have seen them in this Heisenberg spin chain model. This is replaced by something else. So that's the basic ansatz equations. And what we are doing with my collaborator was to analyze the behavior of the beta ansatz equations under when n goes to infinity. So there are many questions you can ask about the beta ansatz equations, right? The one basic question people, question zero, let's say, is completeness. That's the basic question people have always asked, is whether if you do this, you get all the eigenvalues. You just want to know. Sometimes it's just a count. Sometimes, if it's infinite dimensional, you do have to prove something. And that's been studied. And there's also another question you can ask. So fix the sides, fix the alphas, and let k go to infinity. So that question is actually closer to the type of questions people ask in random matrix theory. So fix the alphas, fix those points, and find all those, you know, do more and more k's. Spread them out and find out what happens. Density of those thetas and so on. So that's another thing. We call it semi-classical asymptotic, or my collaborators call it that, but I'm never quite sure what limit is what. And then, of course, the other thing is, well, let n go to infinity. And that we understand as the thermodynamic limit. Because there's a number of sites that are going to infinity. So actually, that's basically the problem we're studying. But before I give you, I'll just write down the results. But before I tell the results, I should actually point out that somehow the reason, well, historically, these equations, although discovered by Detta, were actually known to people who were doing spherical harmonics. And so a little historical thing. Historical remark is, so read Whittaker Watson. If you read the old book, the Whittaker Watson, you'll find that this was studied by Niven to find spherical harmonics, Niven ansatz, if you like, to separate variables on the sphere, a very large dimension. So that's actually very interesting, because the people who nowadays work on that wouldn't kind of relate that. And that's why also these special polynomials play a role. Because if you try to separate variables on even on the round sphere, you shouldn't use radial and angular coordinates. That doesn't really separate. That only gives you two directions, right? It's good for S2, but for S infinity or S a million, it's no good. I mean, you have a lot of symmetry left. So you have to use elliptic coordinates. You know, Niven had papers. Yeah, Niven had papers. So there are some original papers. Yeah. So elliptic coordinates, they separate I would even say the metrics. So to speak. Well, I'm a Newmanian geometer, so sometimes I have to use the metrics. So it actually gives you the best coordinate systems on the sphere, which are orthogonal, and when you write the Laplacian down, it separates. And so harmonic polynomials become products of polynomials of each variable in the elliptic coordinate system. So I don't think I have much time to go. That's actually very interesting, so I would recommend everybody to get this book. And just keep reading. Keep it beside your bed. So I keep it beside my bed. So. And anyway, so that's maybe is an explanation why one can actually go back and see that these equations are related to classical polynomials. And now I'll say that how it related is. So this equation is satisfied, is equivalent to, if you take this polynomial, right, the polynomial where theta k are the roots, then satisfies this equation. I write it down. Maybe I write down a 2. Most people write it minus, yeah. About time. So a second order equation, like an orthogonal polynomial equation, where A, that's just the product, you know, of the alpha, where I chose the sites. And this B is quite special. So B of A is the lambda. And then the statement that there is a C, there's a polynomial, this is also a polynomial. So this is degree n minus 1, this is, and this is n plus 1, right? Because I chose. So these are degree polynomials, and P is the polynomial solution of that equation. So it's, in a sense, a very special type of function. And this is the lambda equation. Well, higher order. And that's a relation to the spherical harmonics. So people study those lambda equations, look at asymptotics and things like that. So that's the link. And now, of course, what we want to do is to, well, I write down the result. Maybe I forgot one little thing. Yeah, that should be okay. So I just write down, so for spherical harmonics, I should maybe point it out. For spherical harmonics, on the spherical harmonics, the lambdas are all equal to a quarter. See, that's not a half, so it's infinite dimensional representation. So you should check what happens for the spherical harmonics, a quarter. Okay. All right, so the results are, well, we don't have, I mean, maybe even before I tell the results, I still want to understand what happens in the plane. So the results are based on a theorem by Steiner-Stieltjes. No, one quarter. You need one more? Okay. All right. Maybe it is three quarters. But it's not half or one. It's between the integral of... Okay. Yeah. Maybe it is three quarters. I just computed the, you know, the way. So you want... yeah, but that's I'm just using it on that, you know, on one octant, right? It's true that there's the elliptic coordinates are given in terms of squares of the original coordinates. So each octant, so it's defined only on the octant of positive xi. So that's because there's a z two to the power n symmetry. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, let's finish this off. So the results are quite simple. But what I wanted to say is, in general, it's still a little not well understood. If you have points on the Riemann sphere and you want to satisfy this equation, what's the relation between the two points? Right? That point set and the other point set, or measures, if you like. And that's still a little strange problem, right? We still don't want to know how to deal with that case, a complex case, but if the alphas are real and lambdas are positive, then there's a big theorem, or very classical theorem by Steiner-Stieltjes. Then the picture is the following. So you start with alpha 0, and you can put them between 0 and 1 if you like. And then, so there are these alphas, and you want to put k points. You want to put the theta, right? There are k of them. So the way to put it is, tell me how many do you want here, how many do you want in each interval. So I have to split, do a partition. Right. And if you give me the partition, there's exactly one solution to that equation, theta satisfying that equation. So that's the Steiner-Stieltjes theorem. And that solution corresponds to certain harmonic polynomials on the for the lambda quarter case. You get the spherical harmonic polynomials. So that's, for every partition that exists, a unique solution to the lambda equation. Okay, that's actually quite useful, because then, of course, we can do asymptotics about how they, so the results are, using that, some of the results are the following type of result. Well, first of all, the density of those thetas as n go to infinity. All right, and that's basically, we have, it's basically uniform density, so it's uniform. So we have estimates also how fast it approaches and what the second moment is and things like that. But let's say it approaches pretty well the uniform density with the rate of 1 over n. It's not quite 1 over square root of n. But. And then you can also ask things about the level surface, level spacing. So that was done earlier, actually, by Todd and Bourget. It's kind of strange, he came back a bit later. So for that, the result is more like for almost every in a 1 over n sense. So you have to take a alpha. So you take a, you think of this as this Hamiltonian integral system parametrized by these alphas, and then you can average over the alphas and then get a result. So for each alpha, maybe, you know, because the alphas might be very special, right? But if you average it out, then you get a result that the level spacing is Poisson. So E minus X dx. And that's basically what people expect, generally speaking, if you have a quantum integrable system, people expect uniformity and Poisson distribution for eigenvalues and root zeros. And for random matrix theory, there's these other, that's more related to quantum chaos. But not, right now we're looking at, which is a little bit of work in progress. I'll finish with that. The last thing is a bit what we... That's right. So in this case, it's just choose... So it's scale invariant. It's invariant on the affine transformation. So you can think of choosing uniformity between 0 and 1. So you give yourself uniform distribution between 0 and 1, and then you order them. In a way, it's in a wild chamber, in the, you know, you order them, right? So, of course, in a way, you could actually choose them to have a weight. So you could give yourself an alpha probability distribution and choose them randomly from that distribution. And you, I'd like to do that on the 3-month sphere, but I still don't know how to do it. But on the real line, it's probably that result can be refined to that, because then you have to integrate against that alpha integral. Like we, in this sense, we just chose the. And that comes to this, the last thing we've been looking at is trying to relate it to, so the, for this equation, maybe I should still write down this equation, it's the critical point for this potential, the usual one that we all know, right, the Vandermonde. Well, the power is actually, if I make it less than J, it's 1. And then I have this weird potential, which is X I minus A N, and L, this goes to K, and N also runs, right? So that's the extra piece, N to the power lambda N, these weights. So that's not the usual type of potential that people study in random matrix theory, because this part is a lot simpler in random matrix theory. So if you write down the log, so you get plus or minus. So that's the usual one you see from the Vandermonde. And pardon? Oh, sorry, that's the alpha. Yeah. And normally in random matrix theory, you have polynomials. You know, e to the minus some polynomial in the x, xi, some of it, something like that. But here, this, if you write it down, it's a little bit weird. It's, they of course, functions like log xi minus a alpha n, right? And some of them over I and n. So these are not very nice functions in a way to apply some of the techniques. So we're looking at that, and what we're finding is actually if you replace this thing by just smooth it off, right, dy, maybe with the alpha, if you want weighted things, you could put a weight there. Just think of alphas being weighted on the line, and that's the function that you could replace this with when you make n go to infinity, roughly speaking. And of course, that's a nice function, actually, for the minus there. That's the function. So that's the function we're replacing this by and trying to do asymptotic estimates. So it turns out that this function depends on the sign. Sometimes it looks like this. It depends on these the charges now. In one case, it's actually not pretty nice. It looks like this, with convex and has a simple max minimum at half. And then if you do the right scaling, you get the random matrix ensemble. This is like a square there, right? Minus half square there. And at the edges, we don't quite know yet. But maybe somebody can help me understand how to do asymptotics or such things. So I'll stop it here, then we can go for lunch.